We'll listen to Ronnie. Ronnie remembers.
Today's guest of honor played drums on 37 number one hits on the Billboard Hot 100. Here's a montage of all those hits.
Johnny Angel, how I love him. He's got something that I can't resist.
Somehow. And I was looking down the bore of the deadly 44 of Ringo.
Ringo, Ringo.
Who wants to buy this diamond ring? She took it off her finger now. It doesn't mean a thing.
I'm gonna walk all over you. Yeah.
Monday, Monday. Can't trust that day.
Strangers in the night, exchanging glances, wandering in the night. What were the chances?
This world can't keep us down. Together we can make it, baby, from the cold side of town.
I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitation. I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitation.
Time is right, your perfume fills my head, the stars get red, and oh, the night's so blue. And then I go and spoil it all by saying something stupid like I love you.
Heaven holds a place for those who pray. don't you know? Everybody knows one song, sung blue. Every garden grows one. You fill up my senses, come fill me again.
People all I've found ever since you've been around, your love put me at the top of the world.
Session drummer extraordinaire also played on 150 top 10 hits and on thousands of records. He is arguably the most prolific drummer in rock and roll history, recognized as having played on more hit records than any other drummer in the rock era. And yes, he is in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Now here's a sample of his drumming as a solo artist on his 1966 album, Drums a Go-Go, his version of a song that was a hit by the Rivieras, California Sun. What an honor it is for me to say, welcome to the show, Hal Blaine.
Thanks, Ray.
It is such a joy to be doing this show with you. When actually did you start deciding that you wanted to play drums?
Well, when I was a kid, I was going to school. I was actually born in Holyoke, Massachusetts, and then at about age 7, we moved to Hartford, Connecticut. And while living in Hartford, I used to go over to this, I thought it was a St. Michael's church. I'm not positive about that at this point, but I used to watch the kids at the church, and they invited me in. One of the priests, you know, they said, obviously I was interested in the drums, so they let me see what they were doing. And then while I was still a pretty young kid, my mother had an old rocking chair, and the doweling in the back of the chair that held the back, I used to take it apart and use them as drumsticks. And those were my very first drumsticks, yeah.
Did you play a lot of pots and pans as well back then?
You know, I won't get into the pots and pans, but I did to a certain extent. Some of my funniest stories are pots and pans stories.
Your sister, Marcia, at some point bought you a little drum set when you were very young.
Correct. My sister, God bless her, may she rest in peace, she bought me my first little set of drums. And I remember it because she bought them for $52 and she was paying them off $1 per week. She was a secretary. I was about 13 when I got that first set of drums from my sister Marcia. And when I was 17, I went in the service. And when I arrived in Korea, they were putting everyone into the infantry. In my case, somehow the IBM cards, I guess, is what they used in those days, pulled me out and put me in this one particular outfit, and it happened to be an engineering outfit, and I became an engineer in word only. And they said there had been a mistake that I was sent to this particular outfit in Korea. They were all geodetic surveyors and geodesic surveyors and photographers. They put me in this group by accident. It turned out that there was a Captain Santos from Boston. And I had been born in Holyoke. And the major, I remember, called Santos and said, there's a fellow down here that plays music. And Santos had a big band, which sometimes was only a duet or a trio or a quartet or whatever.
Right.
Quintet.
Yes.
Sextet. Sextet sounded fine. anyway, he said, don't send him to the infantry. We need a drummer. When he heard I was a drummer, he said, now we've got to have a drummer. So I became a drummer in this big band. That's where I really started a lot of great experiences with music and orchestras. And I just had a natural flair for it. And it went from there. When I got out of the service, I went to the School of Percussion in Chicago. Gene Krupa's teacher and alma mater. Graduated there after 3 years. 52, 53. I wound up going to San Bernardino, and I was given a job with the Air Force Postal Company. And I was driving one of those blue Air Force pickup trucks, and I spent a little bit of time there, joined the union, American Federation of Musicians, and I was sent out on a job, and the rest is history. I mean, they liked what I did, and I started working constantly.
Is it true that your two biggest influences were Buddy Rich and Gene Krupa?
That's correct.
And the school that you went to in Chicago was the Roy Knapp School of Percussion. Roy Knapp personally taught you, and he had personally taught one of those two idols, Gene Krupa.
And so many others out there. I mean, I can't even name them all. Ernie Durara was a great drummer with the Texas Tornadoes. Buddy Harmon was a great drummer that introduced drums to Nashville. Just so many wonderful guys became top-name drummers. There were over 500 drummers in the school, along with an awful lot of boxers, of all things.
Really?
yeah, they did a lot of studying on independent coordination, which was one of the big things that we studied and practiced, because that's what drumming is about, a lot of it in those days, because we were all jazz drummers, bebop drummers, and it was playing rhythm with one hand, catching things with your left hand, catching things with your right foot on your right bass drum, or catching other things with your left foot on your hi-hat, which is the standard setup for drummers. It's amazing how we studied independent coordination. It's like rubbing your head with your one hand and rubbing your belly with the opposite direction with your left hand.
Before we get into some of the specific recordings that you were on, I want to mention a couple of people who were very close to you. One of them was your drum tech, Rick Fauché.
Okay. Rick was an amazing guy, and he was with me over 50 years when he passed away just a couple of years ago.
What does it mean to be a drum tech?
Well, the thing that I introduced to the studio situation, it used to be that when you accepted a recording, one of the union rules was you were allowed what they called cartage. Mm-hmm. Your drums in cases could be delivered to the studio where you were going to be doing the session. It was part of the union contract. Well, half the time that the drums were in one studio and the sound effects were in another studio, and sometimes they were late or not even show up sometimes. But what happens is that all of a sudden I'm getting calls and I'm dovetailing. We could go from one session to another to another to another. There were 3-hour union sessions, and in between certain sessions, I mean, I would take a 5-minute break, which was a union rule, and sometimes a producer would come in from across the hall and say, Hal, could you come over and put some bongos on this, or some conga drums, or some sound effects, or whatever. And sometimes one session became 2 or even 3 sessions. Because on a 5-minute break, I was doing another 3-hour session in 10 minutes, 5 minutes.
Wow.
So that's the way those things worked out. One time I did as many as 7 sessions. People ask sometimes, how did you do 7 3-hour sessions? It would normally be 21 hours, but in this case, 2 or 3 3-hour sessions.
Right.
And the rest were 5-minute commercials, which we called jingles. They were 1-hour jingles. Sometimes it was just somebody wanted me to overdub something on a track that they'd already done and they were in the next studio. I would run over on a 5-minute break. It was crazy. It was absolute lunacy. But that's the way it was, and thank goodness for that. And if it wasn't for that wonderful pension that I was receiving when I finally retired, I'd probably be homeless today.
Wow.
It's just amazing. That's why I try to tell guys, you really should belong to the union, because every time you do a union session on a contract, and that means whether it's in a studio or on a stage at the Hollywood Bowl, whatever, you get a little check next to your name, and the more checks you have, the larger your pension is. And so very fortunately, in 1981, I got completely wiped out in those famous California divorces. And if it wasn't for my pension, I'm telling you, I would be out there hitchhiking. Well, that's the reason that she was entitled to 50% of everything I earned. And it was a lot of money in those days. I mean, we went from nightclub guys earning maybe $80, $90, $100 a week, 7 nights if we were lucky. And then all of a sudden we fell in the studios and you're making $1,000 a day, every day.
Wow.
So it's just incredible. You know, I mean, I can understand what happened with movie stars that go from off of the street looking for work to all of a sudden they're making $10,000 a movie in 20. And today, of course, it's in the millions.
Now, you are a pivotal member of the loose group of skilled session musicians, the Wrecking Crew. But I understand that you named them the Wrecking Crew. And what was the reason for that?
Well, the way it turned out, we started getting calls. Our little group of guys, Phil Spector called us the Wall of Sound. The older established musicians that were doing all the movies, television, pop records, jazz records, everything, were older guys. And they'd been doing it for many years. And they always wore their blue blazer jackets or 3-piece suits. There was no talking on the set. You never spoke on the stages and so forth. And all of a sudden, we came along, a group of guys, Glenn Campbell, myself, Tommy Tedesco, Lyle Ritz, several other guys, just our little small group, and some of these people would come in to hear what this new rock and roll stuff was. Well, I'm talking about the late 50s. Sometimes they would hang around and just watch us, and they would see us in Levi's and T-shirts, and, you know, we looked like thugs. They didn't realize that we were all educated musicians, graduates of schools, and they used to say, and I hear these guys, they say, these kids are going to wreck the business. And there were a lot of musicians, especially drummers, who refused to play what this new genre was, rock and roll. Eventually, I had my own secretary, and I would call her to book a session because I started contracting. Her name was Arlen, A-R-L-Y-N. I say, Arlen, call the Wrecking Crew. Instead of wrecking the business, we were building the business. We were doing movies. We were doing records. This rock and roll, terrible, nasty, filthy music was infiltrating all the movies, all the pilots,
everything.
All the records we were doing. Everything we did was called rock and roll. I mean, man, most of it was just plain old pop music. It came from the beginnings, which were the folk singers. So many of those folk singers became rock and roll singers. The groups like the Mamas and the Papas. Oh, there's just so many. We replaced something like 175, 180 groups of what they call today garage bands. They're guys that sit and rehearse for a month, 2 months, in order to play one track or record one track. We could go in and do an album in 3 hours or 4 hours.
Wow.
And it was just a matter of economics, because studio time was so expensive, and if they're going to sit there and rehearse and rehearse and rehearse, putting out thousands of dollars to the studios, and they were lucky if they even had a hit record. So they finally wised up and started hiring us to replace people like the Byrds, the Beach Boys. It goes on and on and on.
Al, there's some information out there about a few records that you were allegedly on, but in reality, you were not. And one of them was Baby Talk by Jan and Dean.
I was not on Baby Talk, no.
But you are on many subsequent recordings by Jan and Dean, huge hit records. And there's some other examples where you were given credit where credit was not really due.
Unfortunately, there are certain people out there like Sonny and Cher. When Sonny did interviews, he would say, oh, Al Blaine did all our records. Well, I did not do all their records. But some of that was just prestige for them, maybe, or they couldn't think of whoever the real drummer was. And there were people out there who always said, oh, Al Blaine did all my records. And a lot of people who were doing the research for me, doing discography and so forth, which is almost up to 6,000 songs now. That's just recordings. That's not commercials and movies and pilots and on and on and on. I mean, it's just amazing. Demonstration records and so forth. They weren't on contracts, many of them.
You were on Can't Help Falling in Love by Elvis Presley.
Wise men say only fools rush in, but I can't help falling in love with you.
The credited producer on that one was Joseph Lilly.
Well, Joe Lilly was not literally the man standing there. Joe was in charge of music and music production at Paramount Pictures. And Joe Lilly had his name on anything that pertained to music. So a lot of those producers had their names on stuff, and they weren't even with us. They weren't even there. They happened to be in charge of music for the studio. And Alfred Newman and a lot of those people that were at 20th and Warner Brothers and all the big shots, they weren't even there when we did those things. Their credits always came out as they were the people. A lot of times they were not.
Well, you did Can't Help Falling in Love and a lot of other Elvis recordings. And who was in charge of the sessions?
Well, when we were doing that stuff, the engineer was Bones Howe, who became one of the greatest producers in the world. Fifth Dimension, Johnny Rivers, I mean, it goes on and on and on. And also the director, Steve Binder. I can't think of all of them without big lists in front of me. But I worked for just about every producer that came to Hollywood or that lived in the area, and we just did everybody's records.
Amazingly, Hal, the first number one hit that you played drums on was a record that you were not 100% sure that you were on. But I heard from a very reliable source that you did indeed play the drums on the 1962 hit
Johnny Angel, because I love him, and I pray that someday he'll love me, and together we will see how lovely.
Johnny Angel. That was on Cole Picks, and Shelley Fabre was the artist. Stu Phillips was the producer. Paul Peterson co-starred with Shelley Fabre on The Donna Reed Show, and he also recorded for Cole Picks. And I spoke to Paul just a few days ago, and he told me that you, in fact, did all of those sessions.
Well, I probably did and didn't even realize it because so much of it is a blur.
Let's talk about Be My Baby by the Ronettes and your work with the legendary producer, Phil Spector. And it is the one record that probably most people associate with the really beginning of what's called the Wall of Sound. Were you the only drummer that was part of Phil Spector's Wall of Sound when you were doing those recordings?
Yes,
absolutely. You were the wall. It was Hal's Wall of Sound.
You could kind of say that if you wanted to. The thing was, Phil used to hold me back. He didn't want to let me play during the rehearsals. He wanted me fresh as a daisy to go crazy, because he would be in the booth conducting all of us through the glass, and then he would look at me and kind of mouth the word now, and he would point to me, which meant go crazy.
Did you come up with the idea of the way the record starts, bum, bum, bum?
You know, people have asked me that for many, many years. Unfortunately, the arranger passed away, Jack Nitzsche. I don't know if it was a written figure. Being the faker that I was and had the experience that I had, it's possible that I dropped a stick halfway through so that I didn't play it on two, but I did play it on four when I recovered. It really changed the drum world. And I tell people to this day, when I did Strangers in the Night with Frank Sinatra, one of my records of the year, it's exactly the same beat, but done quietly and softly. Wow. And you'll hear the same thing, Strangers in the Night, boom, ba-ba-ba-ba, boom, ba-ba-ba-ba-ba, boom.
Wow.
Not quite that heavy, but it was just very gentle.
Yep.
But it was the same beat. And it was one of those things when we did Be My Baby, it just became, for drummers and percussionists, the biggest thing in the world. If you were playing a tambourine or a shaker can or anything, timpani drums, the fourth beat became a very big beat because Be My Baby.
Working with Phil Spector, was that difficult, or was it like more of a party atmosphere?
You just said the word. It was like a party. There was a big sign on the studio door that said, do not enter, no admittance, recording, etc., etc. And anyone who stuck their head in, Phil grabbed him and would drag him in the studio and say, Hal, give him a tambourine, give him this. It was a party, and I would throw stuff in. From the time I started with Phil Spector, he came from New York, had heard my name, had heard about the Wrecking Crew. He started calling us the Wall of Sound.
The record He's a Rebel by the Crystals, produced by Phil Spector. You were on that one.
The way he walked down the street, that's the way he shuffled.
Allegedly, it was by the Crystals, but was really recorded by Darlene Love and the Blossoms. When you were doing that session, did you know about that, that it would be actually Darlene Love and the Blossoms doing it, but it would be billed as a Crystal's record?
We really were not privy to certain political stuff or business stuff.
Right.
But we knew it was Darlene Love. She did everything with us. When Cher came along, Cher was also a background singer. When we went on the road with Nancy Sinatra, when we went to Vegas, to Caesar's Palace Hotel, it was Darlene and the girls. It was like a family. And Phil, you know, producers are very superstitious. And when they came to see Phil Spector and they saw his theatrics, they wanted to be a little bit theatrical that way, too. The only one who really wasn't was Brian Wilson, because Brian Wilson would come to all those sessions and sit there and just, like a sponge, he was just swallowing in everything he saw and heard and learning, and we all of a sudden became the Beach Boys. The Beach Boys, like so many groups, they only sang on their records.
Good Vibrations is probably the most complex Beach Boys single in terms of the way it was recorded. I heard a story, Hal, that you at one point took three bottles, you taped them together, you cut the tops off to various sizes, and you used the mallets that would be used like on a vibraphone to get a certain sound.
Absolutely correct. You just told the story.
Oh, there's nothing to say.
That's exactly,
so it's,
no,
it's
that's
an accurate,
exactly,
it's an
the story. I was just ba-da-ba, ba-da-da, ba-da-ba, ba-do-do.
Yep.
I just built them like they were like little keyboards, but they weren't keyboards, of course. They were orange juice bottles, and I cut them off three different lengths, and I taped them together, and I used a hard vibraphone mallet, which I always use, like Balter mallets out of Chicago.
I love the colorful clothes you wear, and the way the sunlight plays upon her head. On the wind that lifts her perfume through the air,
I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations. I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations. Good vibrations.
Started in the 1940s for me, because to me they were the Rolls Royce of cymbals. It's just amazing. They're just on their way to Chicago right now. All my cymbals and all my drums, they're going into a museum in Joplin, Missouri. It's called the Hal Blaine Museum.
Getting back to the Beach Boys, did Dennis Wilson, who was the real drummer of the Beach Boys, did he object to you doing these sessions?
Dennis was a very dear friend of mine, because I got to meet him through the Beach Boys. He loved that during the day I was making their records, and at night he was on stage. And during the day while I was making his records, maybe I was making $60 to $150 for the day. That night he was on stage playing those records, and he was making probably $4,000 to $5,000 a night. He loved that I was making the records.
Yes.
Dennis was actually a heck of a pianist. And the proof of all of that pudding is Dennis hired me to work on his Blue Pacific Blue.
Let me do a look up on that. Oh, it was Pacific Ocean Blue. And that was Dennis Wilson's first and only studio album. Came out in 1977.
He loved me. He was terrific. We had our yachts close to one another in Marina del Rey. I was there the day that, unfortunately, his demise, when he jumped off the boat, stone sober. I mean, he had not been drinking with so many rumors about it. Somebody dropped something or something. He was having a little party on his sailboat, and he dove in. And the first thing you learn in yachting is when you're at moor, or when you're moored, when you're docked, you never ever go into the ocean unless you're wearing scuba gear, because the harbor is just unfortunately covered with the worst bacteria in the world. Everybody empties their toilets, etc., into the ocean in the harbor, and it's a terrible thing. And maybe he didn't realize that, but when he dove in, when he came up, there are, if you've ever seen the way boats are tied up in a harbor next to each other, one another, between each boat, it looks like a big, long, maybe 20, 25-foot concrete floating casket. And unfortunately, when Dennis came back up, he hit his head, and he was knocked unconscious. Unfortunately, they didn't find him immediately, and that's how he died. Oh. He had drowned.
So sad.
Yeah.
I do have one other question regarding the Beach Boys.
Sure.
I'm just going to clear my throat for a second. I could use a cough drop.
I have one right here.
Oh, just shoot it to me. You did. Thank you. Did the Beach Boys' father, Murray Wilson, ever try to get into the act when you were recording with the Beach Boys?
Always. Always. He was always there in the beginning until eventually it was forbidden. He was forbidden to be at the sessions, period. Brian had to stop him from coming. Murray was a nice enough man. He used to tipple a little bit because I could always smell the booze on him. His claim to fame at the time was that he had written a little, kind of a honky-tonk, rinky-dink little song that Lawrence Welk recorded. And so somehow, when the Beach Boys, first they were called the Pendletons, then when they signed with Capitol, was a big deal. They're the Beach Boys, and now Murray, the father, is in there trying to produce. And, you know, it didn't work. Anything he wanted to do was absolutely the opposite of what they should be doing. And eventually they had to finally tell him, please don't come around her anymore. And that was the end of Murray. And Murray went out and said, okay, I'll show you. And he started another group called the Sun Rays. And here we were, the same band, making records with a group called the Sun Rays, who lasted, I don't know, I think they did one album that did pretty good.
They did have a national hit single, which got to number 51 on the Billboard Hot 100. That was called I Live for the Sun. And, of course, you were on that one. Before we get to the records of the year, and you had 6 consecutive years when you played on the Grammy Record of the Year. Wow. Before we get to those, I'm just going to shoot just 4 quick songs at you. Maybe you remember the sessions. You were on Ringo by Lorne Greene. That was produced by Joe Reisman.
Well, Joe Reisman was one of the great producers. I think it was RCA. I can't remember exactly.
It was, in fact, yes, RCA.
Lorne Greene, of course, a very nice man and a great actor. He had one of the most expensive toupees ever done. But he was a sweetheart of a guy. And he did this record, Ringo, which became such a major hit because Bonanza was a major, major television show.
The story spread throughout the land that I had beaten Ringo's hand. And it was just the years, they say, that made me put my guns away. But on his grave, they can't explain the tarnished star above the name of Ringo.
Ringo, 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 Ringo.
One of the great things that happened was that every actor in every series wanted to make records. They wanted to be singers. Not only did we did all of the actors on Bonanza, like Landon and the rest, I can't even think of all their names. We did albums with all of them because they were so hot. We were also doing albums with actors like Ken Berry. And I can't even think of all these people right now because there's so many. It's unbelievable.
MacArthur Park, which was produced by Jimmy Webb, who, of course, wrote the song as well. And Jimmy has said that it was like a cross-country thing, kept making a lot of trips to England to work with Richard Harris. So did you have to similarly make a lot of trips to England to do Richard Harris sessions?
Well, I'll tell you a story. I got a call, and I was very, very busy. I was booked months in advance, and I got a call from Jimmy Webb. And he said, Hal, I'm over in England, and I've met this actor. I didn't even know the actor's name, Richard Harris. And he said, we're going to do an album with Richard, and we want to bring you over here to do the album. At the time, I had lost a wife, and I was left with a child. my little Michelle, my daughter. And she might have been, I don't know, 4 or 5 years old, maybe 6. And, of course, I had a mansion in the Hollywood Hills, and I had nurses, and everybody was taking care of everybody. Everything was fine. But I told Jimmy Webb, who was just such an extraordinary man, and what a writer, we were doing all these records for Jimmy. And I think Johnny Rivers sort of discovered Jimmy Webb. I said, Jimmy, remember that I'm very, very booked up, and as long as I got plenty of notice in front. Oh, he said, oh, don't worry about it. It's not going to happen for a long time. Okay, great. Well, it might have been a week later that the phone rang, woke me up, because they were 8 hours in front of us from England, and it was Richard Harris. Hello, Hal. We've got you booked this coming Wednesday at the TWA. I said, what are you talking about? And they literally did. They had me booked first class on TWA flight, whatever it was, going to Heathrow in London for Richard Harris. And I had to call Arlen, who became my personal secretary, and I said, you're going to have to get me out of all this work. I mean, this was only a few days away, and I was booked for months, and I was probably going to be gone for maybe 10 days, something like that. And they were paying me a fortune. And so anyway, I get on the airplane, and I go to London, and we arrive at Heathrow. It was an overnight-type flight, and we arrive around 6:37 in the morning, something like that. And I'm picked up by Richard Harris's people in this wonderful Phantom III Rolls Royce that he had. And I had a Phantom I. I mean, that was just one little connection that we had. And I'm taken to his flat in Belgravia, and I'm sitting there stoking a fire. All he used was coal. There was no wood burning. And I'm waiting for Richard Harris. And meanwhile, his little maid and her husband are bringing me little sandwiches and coffee and stuff, trying to keep me awake. I mean, it's been a long day. And I think we're going instantly to a studio. And all of a sudden, I hear Richard, and it's now about, I don't know, 9:30, 10 in the morning, something like that. And I hear this booming voice of Richard Harris, and he's shouting, Marie! And all of a sudden, Marie, this little housekeeper lady, goes running with a tray of this pink Pimm's, almost like a pink champagne. And she goes running into his bedroom, and pretty soon, here comes Richard Harris. And he's wearing a terry cloth robe that came down to his navel. He was nude from the navel down, and he comes walking in, saying, hello, Hal! He's shaking my hand, and of course his entire body is swinging back and forth, if you get the picture. And this is the way I meet this incredible actor. And Richard said, come on, let's have a little breakfast. And we sit down in the little dining room, and she's bringing eggs, etc., etc. And so I said, Richard, you got me over here so quick and such short notice. I thought we were heading straight to a studio. And he said, well, that's what I want to ask you, Hal. Do you know any good studios over here? I said, you got to be kidding me. I thought we were going. He said, do you know any good musicians over here? I said, Richard, I can't believe what I'm hearing. I thought we were going straight to a studio and that there undoubtedly were musicians waiting for us. And he said, no, 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 no. That's all coming in time. You're over here as our guest. I found out later it was Jimmy's very nice way. I had lost a wife, and he knew how busy I was, and he wanted me to get rid of some stress, I guess. I don't know, whatever it was. Jimmy Webb is one of the nicest people in the world. Also, he happens to be from Oklahoma. And I happen to have a wonderful award and gift from the state of Oklahoma, and I am officially an honorary lieutenant governor of the state of Oklahoma.
Wow.
It was really pretty far out. It was a wonderful award. They have a nice plaque on the wall, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, we were there for 10 days, and it was just a party of listening to Richard and all of his great actor friends, and it was just a parade of all these great actors, the Peter O'Toole's and all these kind of people that I never knew I would ever meet in my life.
Nice work if you can get it, Hal.
Plus, they were paying me just about $1,000 a day. It was just an amazing time. It really was incredible. We came back to the United States, and we went to the studio right behind the Capitol Records studios. It's now KFWB radio station. But they were great studios, and we did a lot of wonderful records there with Neil Diamond and on and on and on and on. and the record was just fabulous. There's been more talk about that record.
Oh, I know.
Because disc jockeys loved the record that was like triple ASCAP or BMI, whatever it was.
Yeah.
Because instead of a 2.5 minute record, it was like, I don't know,
about
7.5 minutes.
I think it was MacArthur Park was actually recorded in the United States, right?
It was done in the United States.
Via England.
MacArthur Park is melting in the dark. All the sweet green ice ain't flowing down. Someone left a cake out in the rain. I don't think that I can take it, 'cause it took so long to bake it, and I'll never have that recipe again.
More records before we get to Record of the Year. One of my listeners asked if your drumming on Dizzy by Tommy Rowe was inspired by the drumming on Game of Love by Wayne Fontana and the Mindbenders. He said there's a similar...
I don't even know that record, but I do know that I did do Dizzy, big record.
Steve Barry was the producer of Dizzy.
Steve Barry, right.
Your drumming is very distinctive on Dizzy.
Well, I learned very quickly in the recording business when I started working studios, part of what makes a hit record is a hook. To this day, they still talk about the hook. What is the hook? Well, the hook in that case was repeating something about every 4 or 8 bars. People get used to hearing that, and that's what hooks them.
And in the song Dizzy, I think it was also the modulation. You make me feel dizzy. Oh, gosh, I'm no Tommy Rowe. Wow. But this guy is.
Modulations were very prevalent. Instead of getting sick and tired of hearing the same thing over and over, you went to the next key or the next key. There were many, many big hit records that modulated.
And one more before we get to the records of the year. These Boots Are Made for Walking by Nancy Sinatra. Producer of that one was Lee Hazelwood, who did a lot of subsequent recordings with Nancy.
Well, all I can tell you is that Lee Hazelwood was a very strange man. He had a voice that was way, way down there. And he started recording with Nancy, and I was Nancy's drummer all those years. I introduced the drums that I designed on the Ed Sullivan Show, doing a solo with Nancy. I started doing Lee Hazelwood's records. He took us to Europe. In France, Lee Hazelwood was like Jerry Lewis. He was given all the biggest awards you could receive. I became Nancy's drummer because she had married Tommy Sands. I was Tommy Sands' drummer. Nancy was not even singing then. She was only about 16, 17 years old. They had a 20-minute Hollywood marriage. After their divorce, Tommy had gone in the service, and Nancy called me and said, I want you to play drums for me. Would you be my drummer man? I said, "Are you?" Of course, naturally.
You keep saying you got something for me. Something you call love, but confess. You've been a messin' where you shouldn't have been a messin'. And now someone else is getting all your best. These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days these boots are gonna walk all over you. Are you ready, Boots? start walking.
I became part of the Sinatra family. It was plain and simple. With Nancy's mother, Big Nancy, Frank Sinatra, Sammy Davis, Dean Martin. Everybody loves somebody. A time that was just impossible to imagine that happened to me.
And you were on Everybody Loves Somebody.
Absolutely. I have an award from Dean Martin on the second album that we did. After Everybody Loves Somebody was such a big hit. And it was written by my dear friend Kenny Lane, who was Dean's pianist and conductor. And Ken Lane and I go back again to the Tommy Sands days, because a couple of times Ken Lane conducted for us before he even knew Dean Martin. And of course, the Dean Martin sessions, those are chapters themselves, because everything we did with all the Wrecking Crew, with Sammy, with the comedian, I forget his name now, all those people, it's an amazing time for us. And these were all just feathers in our caps. You know, every time we made a hit record, you had another feather in your cap. We all looked like Indian headdresses.
Yeah.
we had so many feathers in our caps.
So many feathers, indeed.
That's why so many producers and record companies wanted the Wrecking Crew. That's all there was to it.
From 1966 through 1976, you, Hal Blaine, played on 7 Grammy Records of the Year, and the first 6 of them were in consecutive years. Wow.
Well, Ronnie, I'll tell you something.
Yeah.
Those first 6 years, each time we were at the Grammys, because we were all members, we all belonged to NARIS, we would go to the Grammys just as guests. But the songs that were up for Record of the Year, for example, there were probably 4 or 5 records. I was on all of them. I couldn't miss.
You were on the nominees as well.
Almost every year for 6 years.
Unbelievable.
The song that became Record of the Year.
Plus the nominees.
Starting with Herb Alpert, The Two on a Breath. Plus, there were so many other records that we were on. It's impossible to know. I think only the Grammy people would know. I'd like to get a list from them someday if they would give it out. I don't know. I've been a voting member of the Grammys, and I'm also a voting member of Screen Actors Guild.
In 1966, this was the first of your 6 consecutive Records of the Year. It was A Taste of Honey, Herb Alpert, and the Tijuana Brass. The producers, Herb Alpert and Jerry Moss. And whenever I hear A Taste of Honey, the one thing that I remember more than the tune, I remember the boom, 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 boom. And there's got to be a story behind that.
Well, the story is that that was the hook. That became the hook of that song. What happened was that we were at Gold Star in Studio A, and I was in the middle of the studio, and the Tijuana Brass guys were around me, including Tommy Tedesco. That whole obligato opening, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da- started recording. And I'm sitting there in the middle of the room, and every time we would finish that obligato, nobody was coming in right. And after, I don't know, maybe the third or fourth take, it was a train wreck. When they finished, I looked at the guys, and I started slamming the bass drum. Boom, 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 diddly, 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 and everybody came in perfectly. That became the hook.
I'm Ronnie Allen, so pleased to be talking to Hal Blaine, who's going to do it one more time. Okay, Hal.
And Herb Albert tells that story, too. I mean, I love it. Herb had a surprise party for me a couple of years ago, and they drove me into Beverly Hills, beautiful theater, and all of a sudden, from out of the back came Herb Albert, Jerry Moss, Nancy Sinatra. Everybody was there for this surprise party for me. And they gave me this magnificent, it's framed, it's on the wall, it's going in the Hal Blaine Museum. I just added Glen Campbell to it.
And by the way, we're going to close the show with that very special Glen Campbell record. But right now, we're going to go to the next Grammy Record of the Year. This was the second one, 1967. We mentioned it earlier, Strangers in the Night, Frank Sinatra. Producer of that one was Jimmy Bowen. And Jimmy Bowen started out as a rockabilly singer, and he worked with Buddy Knox, part of the
Rhythm
Records.
That's right. He was a bass player.
You mentioned earlier about how the beat of that was actually...
Identical beat.
Identical beat to the Ronettes' Be My Baby, but slower.
But slower, yes.
I don't think Sinatra would have liked boom, 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 but that loud.
The thing was that Mr. Sinatra was being dropped by Capitol Records.
Right.
And he decided, okay, go ahead, I'm going to start my own company.
Which he did.
And he did, Ronnie, that's exactly what happened. He started Reprise Records, or Reprise as some people call it. He started that company himself. It was his own label.
True, and it was huge. And as for Strangers in the Night...
It was smashed, number one record of the year.
Yes, it was. And I have one question. I got
sure.
the impression from listening to interviews that you've done that actually Frank Sinatra, he didn't record over a track. He was actually singing while you were playing.
He always liked to work live.
Strangers in the night, two lonely people, we were strangers in the night. Up to the moment when we said our first hello, little did we know, love was just a glance away, a warm embracing dance away. And ever since that night, we've been together, lovers at first sight, in love forever, it turned out so right. For strangers in the night. Doo-dee-doo-bee-doo. Doo-doo-doo-dee-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da
what made the record, I think. Now, that was a live session, but most of your sessions, I believe, you did tracks. And then the singers would come in later, is that correct?
Well, it depends on who the singer was and what the situation was. A lot of the groups, we never saw them who, when they came in later and did their vocal overdubs, like Gary Lewis and the Playboys or the Beach Boys, we rarely saw them doing the vocals. We were doing the tracks.
Sinatra was an exception.
Frank Sinatra was an exception, and you better have had it on the first take because generally he only did one take. Only once or twice in all those years when Jerry Bowen or somebody would say, I think we got it. Thank you, Frank. And I heard Frank say, you know what? I really would like to try one more. I think I could do it a little better.
Oh, okay. But that was the exception.
It was a shock to everybody.
Interesting.
Because he was always right. He was always perfect. He started out all his years with Tommy Dorsey and all the great arrangers and so forth. And the thing was that when Frank would say, you know, I think if we could change this, the saxophone, let's make it a beautiful violin, he knew what he was talking about because it always worked. Nancy Sinatra had that same great talent. There were certain things that she would hear, and that had to be handed down from Dad, who was just the sweetest guy in the world.
I read that Frank Sinatra reportedly did not care too much for the song Strangers in the Night. I don't know if that's true.
You know, there are certain artists who claim certain things.
Yes.
Maybe true, may have been just publicity-wise, I have no idea. I was never around for those kind of discussions. I mean, any time I was with Frank Sinatra, I never said, gee, Mr. Sinatra, what a pleasure to record with you. I mean, it just went without saying. I was always at the compound with Nancy, if Frank was there or if he wasn't there. Nancy and her sister and the mom. Frank Sinatra bought them all these beautiful condos right around this wonderful country club. And each child, you know, Frankie Jr., etc., they all received a condo. And Nancy lives there to this day. She has a home in Santa Monica, and Big Nancy's still with us. She's in her 90s. She has a beautiful home in Beverly Hills, but she also has one of those, they call them condos, but they're beautiful homes around the country club right off of Frank Sinatra Drive. That's where the president's been staying with the Annenberg estate.
We're up to 1968 now. Record of the year number 3, and it was Up, Up, and Away by the Fifth Dimension, and the producers of that were Johnny Rivers and Mark Gordon.
Well, Mark Gordon owned the Fifth Dimension, one of the sweetest, nicest, greatest groups in the world. Just incredible. Marilyn and Billy Davis are still married. They're still doing personal appearances, yeah.
Anything memorable about the Up, Up, and Away session?
Well, the fantastic part about it was that when they recorded in the studio, and they were singing with us live, they may have overdubbed, but when they were singing live so that we all knew what we were doing, they had a way of looking at each other and loving each other. You could see the hearts going back and forth between these people, and it came off on record the same way.
Would you like to ride in my beautiful balloon? Would you like to ride in my beautiful balloon? We could float among the stars together, you and I.
To be doing the Steve Allen Comedy Hour show at CBS, and every week there was a new act big in the charts. And this one Sunday, it happened to be the Fifth Dimension, and they were doing their song. Our band was right around the corner of the big drapes that came down, and nobody could see the act or Steve when he was doing his comedy. All the great actors that were on that show, nobody did punchlines. Everybody waited for the actual show. So we were always doing rehearsals. Well, when the Fifth Dimension came on, I'm sitting back there, I have a monitor, and I'm looking at the group, and I'm thinking, oh, great, they're on the show. I didn't even realize that they're going to be on the show. And here I am, I was their drummer. And we're rehearsing. Now, on one side of my headset, I can hear the engineers and the working people. On the other ear, I can hear the producers in the booth. And all of a sudden, as they're singing, Up, Up, and Away, I can hear the television producer, I forgot the name, but it was Steve Allen, of course, and his people, and I hear them saying, only in my headset, where the hell did this group come from? They were standing there almost like wooden soldiers. It was their first time on a big television show.
Yes.
They didn't know where to look. They didn't know what they were doing. They were singing okay, just fine. But I heard these producers and directors. And so, and I take credit for it. Almost like Newt Rockne, I went backstage when we took our break. And I went to their dressing room. And I had a talk with them. And I said, you know, you guys, when we're in the studio recording, you're looking at each other. You're loving each other. And we just all felt it. But here you're standing up there like wooden soldiers. None of that love is coming through. And the producers are not very happy about it. So the next time we get out there to rehearse, let them know what you really do.
Uh-huh.
And boy, they did. And that's all there was to it. Everybody fell in love with them. They were fantastic, and they still are.
But that night, they needed a coach. Hal Blaine, a.k.a. Newt Rockne.
Boy, yeah.
1969 was record of the year number 4. Mrs. Robinson, Simon and Garfunkel, of course, from the motion picture The Graduate. Producers, Paul Simon, Art Garfunkel, and Roy Halley. What could you tell me about Mrs. Robinson? I'm sure you could tell me plenty about Mrs. Robinson.
In the movie, of course, she was the beautiful wife of Mel Brooks in all those years.
And that, of course, was Anne Bancroft.
Laugh about it, shout about it, when you've got to choose. Laugh about it, shout about it, when you've got to choose. Every way you look at it, you lose. Where have you gone, Joe DiMaggio? Our nation turns its lonely eyes to you. Mrs. Robinson, Joe to Joe has left and gone away. Hey, hey, hey. Hey, hey, hey.
Ronnie, I got to tell you, we were working with these kids, Paul and Artie, who were so good. Paul Simon had been writing wonderful songs. Their manager became one of my best friends to this day, Mort Lewis, one of the sweetest guys in the world. And Paul and Artie were just fabulous artists. And they were so good, we actually did some concerts with them, some live stuff that people loved, television shows, etc., etc. Everything they did, we did most of it in New York, but we did a lot of it also at Columbia, CBS, in Hollywood on Sunset, on the Strip. It was just an incredible time. Now, I could spend hours talking about the individual stuff that went on, but it was one of those things where everything clicked, it worked perfectly, they were well rehearsed. Roy Halley was one of the great engineers. Paul and Artie really kind of produced, and Roy Halley was also a co-producer. These guys knew exactly what they were doing. It took quite a bit of time to analyze everything they did. To me, I use the word esoteric. Whenever they sang a phrase and they'd say, well, I don't know, what do you think? I like the way we're singing this. Well, what if we turn this? What if we did this? What if we did that? They went into such esoteric BS, as we kind of thought of it. It was Joe Osborne, myself, and Larry Nechtel playing piano. And that's the way they made records, and that's the way they were absolutely incredible records. Everyone has their own way of working, and that's the way they worked. And you put up with it and shut up and did your job. Paul and Artie and Roy Halley were the kind of guys that anything you thought of that maybe you would like to do on that record, do it. You had carte blanche. I don't care what it was. They never said, no, I don't do them. They loved it. They said, do it, do it. We got plenty of tracks. Do it.
Total respect.
Complete respect. That's a perfect analysis.
I believe that the version of the song in the movie was slightly different from the single. Did you have to do two separate sessions for that song?
Yeah, we were doing the movie. Of course, film is a little bit different than records. And sometimes you're just doing a little bit to the liking of the movie people. The certain cuts, certain timings, and everything has to be perfect. That's all there is to it. Whereas records, you can do things sometimes a little bit sloppy, and it works fine. If it works, it works.
Now we get to record of the year number 5. The first 6 records of the year on 6 consecutive years were only done by 4 different acts, which is amazing. 2 of the acts had 2 of those records of the year. And one of those acts in the year 1970 was the act that you had to kind of convince to be a little bit more animated on that Steve Allen show. Talking about the Fifth Dimension, and they did a medley of the very popular songs from Hair, Aquarius, and Let the Sunshine In. The producer of that one was Bones Howe. The Fifth Dimension, did they sing along with you, or did you do the tracks first?
They always sang with us. In front of us, it was almost like we were on stage.
Did you do the songs separately or together?
Well, most people think you stopped, then you started the second, and I had to explain that we rehearsed a lot. We did it in one take.
Oh, my God.
know that Bones Howe is very much respected.
Bones Howe happens to be one of the great drummers, and he became a very noted engineer. He kind of co-produced and, of course, engineered the Elvis Presley 68 comeback special. Bones had the ears, and he had his hands on the knobs and the faders and so forth. So brilliant.
In 1971, this is record of the year number 6, Bridge Over Troubled Water, Simon and Garfunkel, same producers as before. It was Simon, Garfunkel, and Roy. Anything special about that session? I seem to recall that initially there was a discussion as to who was actually going to sing the song. And what I mean by that terminology is who was going to be the lead singer.
It was Artie that sang the song. It was part of their breakup eventually.
Really? Did they have a disagreement as to who should sing the song?
You know, I was never with them that way, so I have no idea. I never heard shouting or anyone mad at the other. But these were kids that were closer than brothers. I mean, they went to school together, they grew up together, they sang together, and they had great harmonies. That was their hit sound. And what happened was that somehow, I don't know, that song, great song, Larry Nechtel played the introduction, got a Grammy for that. Record of the year that year for me, thank goodness.
When they did Bridge Over Troubled Water, did you do the track first, or were they singing it while you were recording?
Well, it was kind of half and half. I remember that we did it in the middle of the night, as I recall. It was at Columbia in Hollywood. I sent out to my favorite Chinese restaurant, and all the waiters and waitresses brought big carpets for us to sit on, and we had a beautiful Chinese festival in the middle of the Bridge Over Troubled Water. No one ever did that before, and it really left a great impression for Paul and Artie, because they loved me for what I did, but they had never had anyone cater a sit-down, or I should say, sit-on-your-haunches type of catering, and it was delicious. It was great fun, and we knew it was a great record. And I remember that in listening to it, when I heard the song, and I always like to listen to a song first, my motivation, and the song, to me, sounded like, and I mean this with all due respect, it sounded like a black man in chains, somehow on a chain gang, singing this kind of spiritual almost, you know, like he needed a bridge over troubled water. And I thought about the chains. I said, let's break for a second, and I ran out to my car, and I had my big tire chains for the mountain driving, and I brought them in, and Roy Halley found this room. There used to be a microphone room at Columbia, and he said, we'll set the mic up. And I was down on my knees, and I think they got me a couple of pillows to be on my knees, and I overdubbed, like a bridge, boom, over, boom. And on one, I would pull. On two, I would smack the chains down. On three, I would pull again. And on four, I would smack them down. I don't remember how many takes it took, but boy, my back was in terrible shape
A
long time.
This was toward the end of the record, right?
Yes.
Played chains, you played bottles.
Exactly.
You played drums with the wrong side of the stick on purpose.
That's right.
We've talked about and played excerpts from the 6 consecutive hits that you were on, which were Grammy Records of the Year from 1966 through 1971. And though this one wasn't consecutive, you also played on a 7th record of the year, awarded in 1976, Love Will Keep Us Together by Captain and Tennille, produced by Daryl Dragon, a.k.a. The Captain.
Right. The Captain and Shlemiel. First of all, The Captain played great piano. He used to play on certain Beach Boys with us. at times. And I think he went out with the Beach Boys at times, playing keyboards. Nicest guy in the world. His father was Carmen Dragon, one of the great Hollywood composers. Did great movies, and he had great choruses. Very famous. And his brother, Diddy, was a drummer. He was also an engineer. And they had a studio out in Malibu where we used to record the Surf Punks.
Which was, in fact, Denny's group.
I got a call one day, and I think it was Dennis who called me and said, we're going to do something with Daryl and Tony. That's all I knew. I didn't know the name of the captain or the captain and Tennille. So we went in, and I had been on the road. This was during the 70s. I happened to be out with John Denver. We went in the studio across the street from Gold Star. I didn't even know that studio. I don't think I had played there before. It was some little small studio. And we did Love Will Keep Us Together. And it was the captain and Tennille. But even then, I didn't know the name the captain and Tennille. I knew Daryl, and I had met Tony. And we did the record, and it was a fun record, and never thought much about it. On the road, and I used to call home once in a while, and I remember my former barbarian that I was married to. She said, did you do a record with the captain and Tennille? And I said, I don't know that name at all. For some reason, I thought maybe it was you. And I was home less than a week later. It was all over the country, and I was walking down Vine Street, and it was amazing because I ran into Denny. Dennis Dragon, the kid from Malibu, who was also a drummer, big curly-headed kid, mop head, he said, man, we got a hit. And I said, what are you talking about? And he said, well, the Captain Tennille. And I said, I don't think I know them. And he said, yes, that's Daryl and Tony. I said, oh, my God. I've had several calls about that. And I didn't know it was them. Right. Anyway, that's what it was, and it was, of course, a record of the year. Very exciting.
We've mentioned that you, of course, were on the Beach Boys records, where Dennis Wilson was known as the drummer of the Beach Boys, but there were a lot of other similar situations. For example, the Monkees and Gary Lewis and the Carpenters. How did the drummers in those groups feel about you doing the drumming? Were there any hard feelings?
There was only one drummer that was ever upset over me, and that was the Birds drummer. He was the only one that was really upset. I replaced him for Mr. Tambourine Man, and I also replaced him for another one. I can't think of the name. I've got it on tape.
Regarding the Carpenters, a lot of people felt that Karen shouldn't have been behind the drums that much, and she should be, like, in the forefront more, because people would then have a more visually appealing act for that reason when she sang.
Well, that's one of the things that I went through was Karen and Richard and the family. Karen wanted a set of drums built just like mine so that she could play the same sounds that I played on the hit records.
Why do stars fall down from the sky every time you walk by? Just like me, they long to be. The day that you were born, the angels got together and decided to create a dream come true. So they sprinkled moon dust in your hair and gold starlight in your eyes of blue. That is why
Singing.
Of course.
In the year 2000, both you and Earl Palmer were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as a sideman, both at the same time.
That's exactly right. And the reason for that, and I love to tell this all the time, they always say I was the first one to be as a sideman when they started the sideman category. And I always explain that I was the first one because my name started with B.
Alphabetically, yes.
Exactly. Earl helped me so much in the beginning. He was the drummer, period, for rock and roll. And he was the guy that introduced me to all these producers. He said, y'all, listen to this guy. I can't make it on Monday or Tuesday, so get Hal. And then I'd get a call, and all of a sudden, I had a job. You know, it started building my name. And that's because Earl did all of that. And I was so sorry when he passed away. And I speak to his widow on occasion, Jolene, a lovely lady. And I think she lives over somewhere near Las Vegas now.
Considering the amount of work that you did, I assume that you had to replace drumsticks and drums very often. Do you have any estimate of how often that might be?
First of all, I never broke a stick ever.
Never?
Never. Secondly, I may have dropped a stick once in a while,
yeah,
you know, during a take,
yeah,
but I was a good enough faker. And one of the things I learned quickly in this business, if you make a mistake, if you do the same mistake every 4 bars or every 8 bars or every 16 bars, whatever fits, it becomes part of the song. No longer a mistake.
Did it ever happen that you banged the drum so hard that your drumstick went through the drum?
You know, that never really happened to me. There were a couple of great photographers, Alex Solka. He did a great picture of me one time of a broken drum. It looked like I was crawling out of the drum, which was a very neat picture. And he gave that to the Remo people, the people that make the drum heads.
But in reality, it never happened.
And the thing was, I try to explain that to kids when I do clinics. You don't need baseball bats. You've got microphones all over you picking up your drums. If I need something a little bit heavier, I turn my drumsticks over and I use the butt ends. Otherwise, I could just play gently, nice, the way I want, and I play my own dynamics to what the song is. And if it calls for a little more, I turn the sticks over. I try to tell this to these kids because they're all going to wind up with arthritis. The way I was taught at the school in Chicago was that everything was right within reach. From where you're sitting, your hand could reach whatever drum or cymbal or sound effect you wanted. Unfortunately, today, when you see these kids and they got 15 cymbals in front of them and they have to stand up to hit them and stuff like that, that's all theatrics.
Hal, before we get to listener questions, there's an old expression, George Washington slept here. And there's a newer expression, you've heard of that one, and there's a newer expression, which is Hal Blaine strikes again.
Yeah.
That is your rubber stamp.
Well, I'll tell you how that happened. I was on a big date at 20th Century Fox, and somehow they lost the drum tracks when they were mixing to the movie 2 to 3 days later. And they called me and asked me to come in and redo my drums. And I said, sure. And when I went in, they had a librarian, and it was probably a 70-piece orchestra. He brought out 10 times 70 is 700. Pieces of music, and I had to try to find my original drum part. And I was going through, it was probably 5.5 feet tall. Each time I would find the song that I played on, and each cue and so forth. And As I was going through all this music, I saw a funny rubber stamp of a nose with a nostril and a little drip coming out of the nostril. And I thought, that's kind of cute. Finally, I found out that it had to do with Manny Klein, the trumpet player. This had happened to him in the past, where somebody lost him on a track. And so he had to go through the same kind of thing. He decided to have a rubber stamp made, and it was just his nose. He had a large nose. And he would stamp all of his music so that when they called him in, he could just fan through all this music, and every time he'd see his little, he knew that was his piece of music. So I had the same thing done, and it's called Hal Blaine Strikes Again, and to this day, I still use that. I have it in front of me. I'm sitting at my desk. I still stamp whenever I do autograph sessions. I always have my rubber stamp that says Hal Blaine Strikes, and people ask for that. There again, you know, they were paying me double scale, so now I went in. They had lost the track when they were mixing. I had to go in and do it over again. Yeah. And now I'm making four times the amount of money. It was amazing how those things happened. But luckily, I have that same rubber stamp.
I grew up with these records, and I never knew that so many of my favorite drummers were you.
Well, that's one of the famous quotes from a drummer who passed away not long ago. He was the drummer with the neck. Do you remember that group?
Oh, sure. Sure I do. They did My Sharona, and the drummer, incidentally, was Bruce Gary.
He, in an interview, he's the one that said, my biggest disappointment was finding out that a dozen of my favorite drummers was Hal Blaine.
Was Hal Blaine, yeah.
Very nice guy. I became friends with him. I met him and everything.
Well, I said pretty much the same thing, and I guess subconsciously I was thinking of that. And I'm sure a lot of people feel that way. Hal, before we get to the listener questions, I have one more Ronnie Allen question. I assume that to become a successful session drummer, there are some minimum requirements. Could you just tell us a few of what they are? And do you have any advice for any of our listeners who might want to try to become the next Hal Blaine?
Absolutely. There are a few little adages that I came up with. And one of them is, if you smile, you stay around a while. If you pout, you out. You know, a lot of times musicians would come in, look at the music and say, ah, same old crap. And I would have to tell them, listen, you just lost a job here, because the producer's going to come to me and say, don't ever hire that guy again because he thinks our music is crap. And I, you know, it's very hard for me to explain. Oh, it's just a musician making fun of whatever. No, I don't want that man on my session. So I have to tell guys, if you smile, you stay on a while. If you pout, you out. The microphones are turned on when you walk in the studio. And if they're in the booth, they hear everything you're saying. That's just one of the things. There were many, many sayings that I try to tell kids. When there's a five-minute break, don't run right to the Coca-Cola machine or the coffee machine. Hang around, listen to the record. Act like you enjoy what you just did.
Do you have to know how to read music to be a session drummer?
It's very, very important, because studio time is so expensive, they don't always have time to let you try to memorize the song. It's very difficult. And you may have, you know, over 100 bars of music to play. I've been there with our little band where the producers didn't realize that we did read music, and they wanted us to memorize it, and when they kicked it off, we played it perfectly, and the composer said, holy God, why didn't I record that? That was perfect. The only analogy that I use is of driving an automobile. First time you drive an automobile, you're scared to death, you're white knuckles, you're whatever, you're looking, and after you've learned to drive, now you're turning on the radio, you're waving at people, you're putting your arm up for a left turn, whatever. It becomes second nature. Once it becomes second nature, you got it.
I'd like to acknowledge a couple of Oldies message boards whose members provided me with some listener questions, namely Mike Riccio's board, www.oldiesboard.com, and Ron Smith's website, which contains what he calls the bulletin board, www.oldiesmusic.com. This is a tough one. I guess when I ask for your personal favorites that you drummed on, probably many of them that we discussed would fall into that category. Is there any one that I didn't discuss that you'd like to mention?
There's a song by the Fifth Dimension called Dimension 5. One of the greatest songs I ever luckily did on drums. I think about it all the time. I think I opened it with Brushes. For me, one of the great drum items that I was lucky enough to do.
Some of my listeners may own a copy of that without even realizing it, because it was the flip side of a hit Fifth Dimension record called Save the Country that came out in 1970. It was also from the Fifth Dimension album called Portrait. Hal, you've played on several TV theme songs. Off the top of your head, could you tell us what you think was the best known?
Well, the big one that's still going so big today is Three's Company. And you hear more drums than you've heard in a long time, especially during that era when guys only had a set of drums of four drums. My set of drums had a complete octave. I designed a set of drums that I could play musically.
Come and knock on our door.
We've been waiting for you.
Where the kisses are
hers and hers and his. Three's Company
too. Come and dance on our floor.
Come and dance on our floor.
Take a step that is new.
Take a step that is new.
Leave a lovable space that needs your face. Three's Company too. Down at our rendezvous.
One of my listeners wants to know, did you play drums on I Woke Up in Love This Morning by the Partridge Family and Diamond Girl by Seals and Crofts?
Well, I don't think Seals and Crofts, but there's a good chance that I did the other one with the Partridge Family. I did a lot of their records.
Okay.
They were all good friends. Shirley Jones, I drove her in a parade one year in my Rolls Royce. I had an antique yellow Rolls Royce. And she was a sweetheart. I drove her one year. I drove Glenn Campbell and his family one year. I drove these other kids. They were big Western kind of stars. I drove them one year.
One of my listeners says one of his favorite records on which your drumming is especially prominent is Mississippi by John Phillips of the Mamas and the Papas. And you're even name-checked at the beginning of the record. You hear possibly John saying, "Hit it, Hal."
Hit it, Hal.
Early in the morning, she hitched a ride down to Louisville, holding on to $100 bill. Dressed herself like a Cajun queen in New Orleans, baby, and she looked good like a lady. Do it to me, Jane.
The listener wants to know if you were ever mentioned like that on any other recording.
I do know that everything I did with the Mamas and Papas, they always gave me great credits for it.
Yeah.
To this day, I'm still very friendly with Michelle Phillips,
okay,
the only survivor of all the Mamas and the Papas.
Yes.
Just a sweet lady, and she's attached to an old friend of mine, a doctor. John was respectfully very, very nice, always to me. Mama Cass, of course, I did so many great records with her in commercials and things. She was a sweetheart, and they're all gone, unfortunately.
The other one was Denny Doherty.
Nice Irish kid, good singer.
Now, here's a question you don't have to answer if you don't want to. Of all the famous performers you backed up, who had the hardest time staying unbeat?
Probably Eddie Fisher. He had a terrible concept of time. The conductor would be back there mouthing.
Really?
Like he'd be singing along and we'd be at bar 31, and all of a sudden he's singing at bar 53. And the conductor would be shaking his head saying, 53, 53. So that we knew where we were. He had a habit of doing that. Some people just don't have the talent, I guess, to stay in the place that they were supposed to be.
Do you have a preference regarding specific microphones as for drums and cymbals? No. Okay.
Absolutely none.
Okay.
I had no idea about nomenclatures, the Neumanns, and the various, some of the shirts that they gave me, the Shure microphone people, they're all lovely people, but that was one of the jokes that I used to laugh at when I was a new engineer. You know, generally when I went into a session, my reputation preceded me because they knew that they would put their microphones wherever they wanted to, and they knew they were getting my sound. But when it was a new guy, and he's trying to make a name for himself, and he might say to me, excuse me, drummer, we're trying to get a little higher sound on this drum, or whatever, you know. And I know he's full of baloney, and what I used to do is I'd reach over to my trap case and take a drum key, and I would start making noise on my drum. Then I'd hit the drum, I'd say, how's that? And they'd say, oh, perfect, that's just what we wanted. It's just a trick of the trade, and I know they use it today.
Now, earlier we mentioned Rick Fauché, and I understand there's another guy who was very important to you, Howie Oliver.
Howie was a drum tech at the Professional Drum Shop in Hollywood, and he was one of the guys that helped me in the design and the building of my first big drum set that I put together that everyone else calls rack toms and so forth. And I gave it all to Ludwig because I was a Ludwig drummer, and they thanked me for it profusely. I never patented anything. I didn't know about design patents. And when those drums were finished, I played those drums and introduced them on an Ed Sullivan special with Nancy Sinatra and changed the drum world. Every drummer I knew and every drum company went from what they used to call a regular four-piece set of drums. Pretty soon they were all more than an octave. There was a Gene Krupa set, and there was a Buddy Rich set. I wanted them to be the Hal Blaine superset.
But Ludwig decided to give it a different name, which was?
The Octoplus. It's a great name. It was their biggest seller in all those years.
And Hal, you are indeed the Tom Tom man.
That's what I'm talking about, the Tom Toms.
I read an interesting story. Beatle George Harrison was inspired to buy a monster drum set like yours for his Beatle friend Ringo Starr. Only four sets of those custom kits were known to exist. After receiving the gift, Ringo reportedly sent a thank you note to you that read, "Thanks, Hal, for the Tom, 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 Toms."
Exactly. It was brilliant.
You remember that?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Great story. One of my listeners mentioned a Phil Spector recording from the legendary Phil Spector Christmas album called The Bells of St. Mary's. And he said, did you, Hal, take off at the end of that song on your own, or did Phil explicitly ask for you to do so at the very end?
Well, at the end of any of Phil's songs, he would look at me and kind of mouth the word now, N-O-W. And he'd point to me, like, meaning go crazy. And I would go crazy. beats and on beats and side beats. It wasn't over until I played my quarter note triplets. That was to let the band know that this will be the last 8 bars that we're doing of the fade over and over and over and over. It was crazy times. Phil said many times that at one point he was going to put out an album of fades of all these records that we did where I literally went nuts on the drums for the length of the fade.
Did you ever think of possibly becoming a record producer?
You know, I tried a couple little things. I remember when Joe Osborne, one of the greatest bass players in the world, came to me and he brought these 2 kids, Richard and Karen Carpenter, and he said, you should be producing these kids because they're great. He was recording them in his little garage studio at home. And we had just come out on a 5-minute break from Neil Diamond. I said, Joe, when do you or me or anyone else have time to produce anybody? It's just not possible. I mean, we did not have time. We were lucky to be able to go to the bathroom. So I never even thought about taking on a new artist. And in a way, I'm glad I didn't. I mean, I'm glad that they had the hits that they had. You know, Richard is a spectacular guy, and Karen was just the greatest. She was a dear friend. I always hugged her, and she felt like a little bird had fallen out of a tree. She was nothing but skin and bones. We all knew that she was very, very sick, just like Elvis. Everyone knew that Elvis was killing himself with these pills, but you couldn't say a word.
We got just a few more questions. How does one get a pair of used Hal Blaine drumsticks?
Well, you know, I got to be honest with you. At this point, they're all gone.
Oh, gee.
The sticks that I had have gone to various people through the years. The only pair that I really have left are a pair of what they call signature sticks. They're my sticks with my imprinted signature. They're Zildjian sticks really made by the Vic Firth Company that makes everybody's.
Over the years, were there hundreds of sticks that you used?
No, I didn't really use that many sticks.
You were easy on them.
Smash. I was not one of those metal groups. I was playing normally, and the microphones were picking me up to my satisfaction. If there was a place I had to play heavy, I played heavy. If there was a soft area, I played soft. Just my normal dynamics. And that's one of the reasons that people love the way I played on their records, especially songwriters.
And some of them you actually just switched around and used the other end of the stick, as you mentioned.
If I needed something really heavy in some particular place, I just played the butt end. You'll see many pictures with my left hand playing the butt end.
There was a movie that came out a few years ago, and you were a part of the movie. It was called The Wrecking Crew, and I wanted to ask about that. There's one musician we haven't mentioned, and there's a certain amount of controversy, and I don't know how much you want to go into that, but we're talking about Carol Kay.
She was not a part of The Wrecking Crew.
Could you clarify that? Because there's a lot of confusion about that.
Well, when I heard she was going to be in the movie, she was a guitarist. She was not a bass player. Every time you see a picture of her, it's with a guitar, in the guitar section.
Yes.
Phil Spector wanted her on some of the dates because she was a married woman or a divorced woman, and she was raising a couple of children. One of them had passed away recently, unfortunately. But this gal is just, she wanted to be known as the first lady of the bass. And she wasn't. There are so many great bass players, and Carol was not that good a bass player. She was a fine guitarist, sitting there amid 3, 4, 5 other guitars, and she did stuff.
You did work with her, right?
I worked with Carol, but not necessarily with the Wrecking Crew.
With the Wrecking Crew.
She happened to be a female guitar player who happened to be on a session, because it, generally a rhythm section was piano, bass, drums, and guitar. Soprano, alto, tenor, and bass. I mean, musically, that's how it breaks down.
Right.
The bass player that did all those great Beach Boys stuff with us was Ray Pohlman. P-O-H-L-M-A-N. And Ray, unfortunately, died in the midst of being such a great bass player. He passed away. He was a composer also, and he was doing a lot of television. Mm. And Carol had been experimenting with a mid-bass. It's between the Fender bass and the stand-up bass. There's another higher bass. I forget the name of it right now. And she jumped in with that. So all of a sudden, she took over Ray Pohlman's job. And we did several big hits. And she did a couple of things with Glenn Campbell. She did a couple of things with the Beach Boys. and all of a sudden she's the first lady of the base, which she wasn't. She's out there doing interviews today saying there never was a Wrecking Crew.
Yeah, I know that.
It was all a lie. The Wrecking Crew never existed. She was saying we were called the Click.
And there's no truth to that at all?
Absolutely none. Yeah. Absolutely none.
Would you recommend the movie The Wrecking Crew? Because you were in the movie.
I haven't seen it yet.
I haven't seen it either. You want to go there with me? I'll fly out and we can watch it together.
I'll tell you what I've learned, Ronnie. This is very important. I've learned that when you go into these venues where there's all these people, it's like walking into a human petri dish. Everybody's coughing. Everybody's sneezing. Everybody wants just a couple of pictures with you. Shake hands. Give me a hug. Give me a kiss. I can't do that anymore. I've just stopped doing it. I was just booked for Elvis Week in Memphis, paying me a lot of money. I said, I can't do it. It's just not possible. I did sign a contract. I was going to go. And then I said, it's ridiculous for me to fly 4, 5, 6 hours, changing airplanes, etc. It's all first class and plenty of money, but I can't go into Graceland and start hugging people and taking pictures with everybody who wants a picture. Everybody wants a picture. It's just the way it is.
Pal, from the bottom of my heart, on behalf of myself and all of my listeners, you just have been a wonderful interview subject. I mean, I can't thank you enough.
Well, listen, it goes right back at you because I'm sure your listeners, hopefully they really enjoyed what they were hearing. A lot of people just did not know who the Wrecking Crew was. They may have seen it on record, but they never really knew who it was. Now they'll know. That's fantastic.
To use the analogy about you being a horse at the starting gate. So the information about the Wrecking Crew is from the horse's mouth. To be fair, Hal, you aren't really the horse. You are actually the jockey. Just to be technical.
So to speak.
Hal, I wish you continued health, happiness, and success. And I want to say a very special thank you to a close friend of yours, Clifford Hughes, who made this show possible. And it'll also help me immensely with my research. What a guy.
Absolutely.
Right now, we're going to close the show with a brief discussion and playing of this very important record. 2015, I don't know, it may have been recorded in 2014, but it won the Grammy Award for Country Song of the Year. Glenn Campbell was one of the two writers of the song. The other one was Julian Raymond. And the song is called I'm Not Gonna Miss You. And, of course, it has to do with the fact that Glenn was diagnosed back in 2011 with Alzheimer's. This had to be a very special recording for you. Can you tell me how you got involved with doing what was Glenn Campbell's final studio recording and was featured in the documentary about Glenn called I'll Be Me?
The director, James Keach, brother of Stacy Keach, called me. He had been the director on the Johnny Cash movie, Walk the Line. Very nice man. And I had a nice talk with him. He said, I want you to please come in. We're going to do interviews. Warner Brothers will be here, cameras. And we want to record with Glenn live. And I said, sure. He asked if I could get a couple guys. I said, sure, man. And I called Joe Osborne, of course, who happened to be in town working with Richard Carpenter. And I called Don Randy, the great pianist, one of my oldest friends from Hollywood. He's the owner of the Baked Potato in Hollywood for about 45, 50 years now. And I brought them in. We met at Western Studios, now called Ocean Way, and we sat there doing interviews on camera for an entire day with Glenn, with the director. And one of the producers was Jane Seymour, the British actress, very nice gal. And she and her sister was visiting from England with her husband as Jane's brother-in-law. And they were extremely nice people to us. I had no idea that Jane was co-producing the movie. She was married to James Keach. And Glenn's wife was there, just a sweetheart. A couple of his kids, his son Cal, who's a dear friend of mine, he's a great little drummer, was doing all of Glenn's stuff at the time. And a number of well-wishers and different people from Warner Brothers, etc., etc. They did all these individual close-ups of us. interview after interview after interview. It was all over. They brought Glenn in, came a guitar, and he sang it perfectly. He played it perfectly, and we recorded. And it came out great. And they, of course, these were all these cameramen around, taking all this video stuff of us. And when we finished, and we were all hugging Glenn, and good to see him. Glenn is smiling, and I don't think he knew any of us. I'm not sure. I have not seen the movie, and I want to see the movie, and I guess it's doing great. I can't believe some of the checks that are coming in, which is wonderful, except we all wound up on the cutting room floor, except for the end of the movie, they did use us recording Glenn.
Ronnie remembers.